I'm speaking today with Don Murray and Dale Lutz from Safe Software. And to make sure that we keep them straight, I'm going to have them introduce themselves.
Okay. My name is Don Murray, and I'm one of the co-founders of Safe Software. And Safe Software has been around now for about 13 years.
Yes, and I'm Dale Lutz, and I'm the other co-founder of Safe Software, and I've been with Don the whole time. And all that I'll say is that the pictures of us that we have from when we started the company don't look a lot like we do now.
Well, if they did, we couldn't believe that the company was actually 13 years old, so that's a good thing.
Yes.
So even though you've been around for 13 years, this was, in fact, the first year that you had a user conference.
Yes, that is correct. It was. We have done other user conferences kind of in Europe. We also did one in China, but we've never actually done a worldwide one or a conference at all in North America before this year.
Yes, and so the interesting thing, and this is Dale speaking, we actually did, I think, we'll never forget it, September the 10th, 2001, we had an Austrian user conference with a number of people from Austria there, and that was the first one that I know of that that really gathered together the users as a group. But since then, we did them in, as Don said, Sweden, other places, and we were talking this spring early and said, you know, these events are great successes all over. The reason that they're happening is other people, our partners, are organizing them for themselves. Maybe it's time we did it ourselves. And so then we did get a relatively late start on this because the idea didn't really get solidified till probably May or June. But nonetheless, we decided to go for it this fall.
Okay, so if other companies are sort of, you know, plugging along and have products and have users, how do you sort of know when you're ready to have sort of the first international user conference?
And that's the big question. One of the things that we always felt worked against us here in North America compared to Europe is that the distances are so much larger. These events that we've had in Europe typically don't require people to spend a day traveling, coming and going. So the densities are just much greater. So the one in Austria, the people all could ride a train, many of them that morning, to get to the event, or similarly in Sweden and so on. But here it's a very big expense. So we felt we needed a pretty big user base before we would go for it. The other thing to mention is that we did actually hold kind of a trial user conference, if you like. It wasn't a worldwide one, but we did one in the city of Calgary in May. And we just invited all of our users. For whatever reason, in Calgary, we have the largest or the most concentrated geographically group of users there. And so we invited all the users from Alberta and Saskatchewan, actually. The vast majority were located in Calgary, and we had 105 sign up and 85 attend a one-day event there. Now, that one worked for us because, again, the geography was on our side. Going for the worldwide, we're expecting people to fly in from all over. That was a bit more of a stretch, but we decided to just go for it. But to give you an idea, I think, what do we have?
I think we had about 80, again, about 80-ish users who showed up, and they came from, this is Don speaking, they came from as far away as India and
I think there was
South Africa and Australia and many from Europe. And then, of course, as you got closer to Vancouver, there was more of them, but it was a huge success.
I think 16 countries were represented. And we have, I think there's around, 5,000 or 6,000 FME sites?
Yeah, there's about
something like that.
Yeah, there's about 5,500 FME sites.
So that, I guess, you know, if somebody was going to, I guess in Safe Software's case, we waited until there was 5,500 sites before we went for our own conference.
Don, again, our general consensus is that we should have done this earlier, but certainly we're glad we did it and we'll do it again.
Yes.
Now, is it going to be an annual kind of thing, or are you still working that out?
We're still working it out. It's going to be the choices on the table are annual, 18 months, or 2 years. And again, because the distances are large for some of these folks, the feedback certainly from many of them was that they felt that a year was a bit too soon to make the journey in our case. So, but we'll see. There's also a lot of people that said they'd like to come to Vancouver in the winter so they can go skiing. So
maybe that's why they want 18 months.
Yeah.
Good spring.
And well, then you'd have geography working in your favor.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's important. Now, how did you figure out what kind of things to offer? Clearly, you offered something that brought people in from all over the world, so it was somehow it was the right mix.
Right. That was kind of an interesting progression. In the case of the Calgary user event, we primarily approached that one as a morning, kind of a general what's up with FME, and then the afternoon we had, I think, three parallel sessions going that were fairly in-depth training, really, or detailed discussions about different things. We did have some user stories in Calgary, but the majority of the weight was carried by Safe Staff. So when we started to think about this user conference, we again had that in mind. But as it ended up, we had so many users that wanted to present such interesting set of topics that we ended up really distributing that presentation load much more widely across a large number of people.
And we also did a bunch of things that were fun. We had some FME Idol competition that was basically done in a really fun way to get users who we thought we handpicked a few users who are we call them MVPs. They're are really some of our better users who have contributed to our user groups. And they basically got up there, and we gave them problems, and then, you know, there was help from the audience, and it was something very different from any other user conference we had been to, and it was risky. We were all worried that it might not come off, but it ended up being hugely successful, and all the participants were very jovial, and it was just a lot of fun, and I think it really amazed. I know Dale and myself, some of the things these guys pulled off in such short order was really amazing.
So. To be honest, the problems that we gave them were probably too hard to do in 40 minutes in front of a live audience. But they did, two of them pulled it off. And the thing that I think was shocking, and this is sort of a side note really, with FME's progression, in the oldest days, we were only a command line, basically a text editor and command line. That was your user interface. And the early adopters loved that, and many of them still operate with FME in that way, even today. However, the vast majority of people that have been using FME since probably the year 2000 are 100% only using our graphical user interfaces, the workbench that we've shown you before. Right. When we did this MVP FME Idol, one of the four contestants was a longtime FME user, and he went at the problems with the command line and a text editor. And to be honest with you, I thought the poor guy was, you know, I didn't think he'd get very far in his short order typing. Well, it turned out that he basically tied for first place. He had brought with him some CDs of all his old mapping files. He didn't even know he was going to be in the contest, actually, till the day. And he happened to have brought with him, maybe he doesn't leave home without him, his CDs of all of his various libraries and things, and he was able to piece together on a non-native keyboard either. He was a Danish guy,
so
the backslash and stuff was in the wrong place. Nonetheless, he was able to tie a guy using the graphical tools.
That is a great story, and it sounds like you learned as much from putting on this contest as people had fun participating in it and watching it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think we all, we realized. Actually, I learned new ways of using our tool, to tell you the truth,
absolutely.
That I had never thought of. And, you know, Don and I, as kind of the inventors of it, it's sort of humbling to be able to see that and learn from other people, that's for sure.
Yeah, we also did some other fun things, too. We had doctors walking around who were wearing white lab coats with mirrors on their foreheads. And basically that was so that they could be identified by people. And any user could just basically, there was probably about 10 of these guys walking around, and they would bring problems to these guys. And then we'd have doctors' reports in the main hall throughout the conference, where they talk about new requests for functionalities or problems that people have seen they would like solved, or how they solve problems using FME. And again, having these guys dressed up like that just sort of took the edge off and made them much more approachable to people, and it just really made it a very relaxing and sort of enjoyable event.
But my feeling is we probably won't do an international user conference outside of Vancouver. For this reason, we have now got about 70-some people in this company. 30 or so are developers. Don and I are the original developers. We always had a very customer-facing side. We've always interacted lots with customers and felt the pain on site when things didn't go quite the way they should, or this feature or that didn't give the right feedback. When you get so many developers, it's hard to have those folks all be as customer-facing. And, in fact, many of them rarely would get in front of a customer or have any interaction. By having the user conference here, slapping mirrors on some of their heads and putting them face-to-face with clients. And we had 10 development staff basically with the mirrors on or the doctor's suit, but we had every developer down there listening and learning. I think, you know, even if we got nothing out of the conference from a customer side of things, we absolutely improved our own training internally and our own attitudes internally about how important things are when we're developing.
And the developers really enjoyed it as well, of course, because they got to talk to people who actually used their stuff and to see the just amazing problems that, that these users, who are the true experts of our tool, are doing with it. And, you know, I think all of them probably left a little humble just to see. I mean, we built this wonderful tool, but it's the magic isn't really the tool. It's what these brilliant people who use this tool create and they do with it, and their organizations depend on it. And you know, a couple of the developers, you know, I heard one of them say, holy smokes, this is kind of scary what people are doing with our stuff. And that's the best thing for a developer to realize, is that they're working on real-world stuff. It isn't, you know, software can become a kind of abstract at times, but when you actually meet somebody who's from a major organization using it on a day-to-day basis and relies on it, it's a very good experience for them.
Right. So it sounds like you guys took a lot out of this. What kinds of things did you hope that the users who attended took back to their shops?
Well, the thing, Don did a big trip to Europe just prior to the user conference. And one thing that kind of shocked me when he came back was the level of, or the lack of knowledge about the stuff that we've been up to for the last maybe 2 years out there, even among some of our close partners. And so we were really hoping to bring people's level of knowledge of all the things that we've been up to, which we think are very valuable and helpful and useful to people, but they just may not know. And, you know, we're doing some self-examination about how we communicate. If we have an army of 30 people here cranking out stuff, we probably need to have a equivalent army that's at least trying to educate people into how, as to what that stuff even is. You know, people start using a software package and it does one or two things that they wanted it for. They're not generally motivated to go looking to find out if it does more things. And so that's, you know, when we do training, when we visit people, they always say, wow, I never knew it could do that. And so that was really our goal, was to just raise that awareness so that people realize the more things they can get done.
And the other side would be to have users meet other users. Like, it's always amazing to see when users see other stuff that other users are doing. It's one thing to see a vendor go up and say, you know, this is what we're working on and this is what it can do. But to actually be able to talk with another user who has it running and deployed and in a real system is really good. And just to see the users, you know, really go to other talks and really get into what that other person has to say. And, of course, the users love to present some of these wonderful things. Like, if you go to our website, you'll see some of the, you know, the fun things that people did. There's lots of serious stuff, but you know, one guy used FME to play chess and things, and it was really good for the users to really have a good time and really learn about our technology.
We have one guy that he's become famous. He's actually a very power FME user, and he did present a serious talk as well. But as a hobby, he plays with FME to create art. And we had an unveiling of a new art piece during the conference, which was actually a very fun thing.
And we do have a lot of fun here, you know, with all the developers, and we have fun. We love what we do, and we just have a good time. And I think that was carried off through the what some people might think crazy things we did at the conference, like the doctors with the mirrors, and the FME art and the FME idol. But at the end of the day, users left with, you know, knowing that FME does a lot more than they ever thought of. And we got lots of great feedback to the doctors, where I think it made them, again, really approachable, rather than just having a staff badge because they had, you know, stethoscopes and a whole bunch of real funny stuff.
Okay, well, let's shift away from the conference for a bit. And one of the things that I think about when I get the latest press release that says, you know, Safe Software has the latest edition of FME is, you know, what could they possibly add is what I always think of.
We did a graph the other day, or we have here this sort of, you know, like the gold albums of Elvis. We've collected all the CDs, and we've got them in, there's 16 of them, in two cases, and below them they have a little plaque, each one with the name of the release and the year.
And the number of formats.
And the number of formats. And as a lark, about a year ago, I I plug that into a spreadsheet. So I've had the dates in there and the number of formats. And I put it, made a graph, and I really, to be honest, didn't know what to expect. My impression was that it should have been tapering off, just as you're saying. But indeed, it was exactly a straight line.
Yeah.
Like very little variation off of a straight line. So as time has gone on, the number of formats has increased at a linear rate.
Yeah, so now we're around 170, and you know, and there's more formats being added.
Like GRSS, for example, just pops out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
And to be honest, we should almost count GRSS as, what, 12 formats? Because there's three different, there's something, I don't know, there's four or three different ways of RSS, and and then there's three different ways of doing the geo parts, so you have to multiply those together. But I think we'll only count them as one.
Yeah. And something else that's interesting, too, is we also now users can submit statistics automatically if they choose on what they're doing with FME, like, you know, what source format, destination format. And again, we've had about a year of this data coming back, and the number one thing people still use FME for, which is really shocking, is going from shape to shape. So, which is kind of an interesting statistic, certainly not one we anticipated.
The most prolific use appears to be going shape to shape, which kind of goes back to our argument that we haven't probably made well, that the key value in FME isn't so much the formats as it is the transformation, the ability to massage the data, change the schema around, and so on.
Yeah.
That's the value, and that's what's going on. When they're going shape to shape, they're not making a file copy.
No.
They're somehow doing some massaging in some interesting way to produce an output that they can better use later on for whatever their purposes are.
So the true value is in the transformation. So, you know, we've coined the term spatial ETL, and really the extract and load is just really format support. And of course, you need to support the formats to get started. But really, once you have the format, it's the transformation. And if anybody hasn't used our tool recently, if they fire up Workbench, you'll notice that the vast majority of the time and the focus of that tool is all about the transformation aspect. It's not so much about the formats. We've worked hard to try to make the format the thing you think about the least.
Don's quote is that formats are irrelevant. But yet they are, you know, a key part of what we do, but in some respects they are irrelevant once you have the technology in place.
I mean, of course, we're also working to push stuff onto the server. We've had our Spatial Direct product for a number of years that provides the ability for people to get access to data from some web tools. Now we're expanding that into what we're calling a Spatial ETL server, which you'll see, you know, in the new year, to again help with larger organizations that have a need to have this transformation capability, at the server level, not just the client level.
I know, Adina, you'd asked me probably 2 years ago about our web services angle, and at last there's going to be a shrink wrap product that at least heads down that path.
Another area that's very exciting for us is integrations with non-GIS ETL packages, such as IBM Essential, Informatica, Microsoft SSIS, for example. There's many. I think we're a little ahead of the market here, but we are seeing some need for those tools to work with spatial data with some clients, and we have integrations with those. So if you go to like safe.com/informatica, you'd find out about that one there, and then I think /IBM, you'd find about the one there, and
SSIS or Microsoft, I can't remember.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, I don't know if those sort of traditional ETL tools may not cross your desk too often, but in some organizations, they do use these already for moving around their non-spatial stuff, and so there's an attractiveness to be able to bolt in the same interface, the same mechanisms, but indeed to carry through the spatial information that's part of their back office grinding, moving data around. And so, in fact, Don, you're going to be at the
IBM show next week. The IBM's having a big show next week in Anaheim, and we'll be there showing the integration of our FME spatial ETL technology with the IBM Essential ETL technology.
We should do a press release.
Should.
And now, in most of these cases, it's been an interesting user interface and integration issue to kind of pull that off because, of course, their tools are not designed with spatial in mind.
Yes.
And so figuring out how we find a mix of how much of our user interface do we present versus using their user interface exclusively and drawing that line. With each of these tools, I think it's been a little different cut that's been made. In the case of the Microsoft one, we end up basically throwing away our user interface nearly entirely, and we 100% bolted into theirs, so somebody can use the Microsoft SSIS and do various spatial and attribute operations using our technology underneath, but they don't necessarily know.
So in that solution, you don't even see Workbench. You just see SSIS, and we just add a bunch of new data sources and a bunch of new transformation objects to it. And so, because the SSIS is very much like Workbench, whereas the other environments are much generally at a higher level. So we would use Workbench to basically define a complete spatial flow or
task of
task,
some kind.
And then that would be dropped into that those
right.
products.
And in addition to sort of, you know, working alongside those kinds of products, I understand you're also licensing technology now.
Yes.
Into your product.
Like we've licensed it like to ESRI with the data interoperability extension.
That's the most complete.
Yeah.
Basically, they get a purchaser of the data interop has, I don't know, 80% of all of FME. Basically, all the things that there's no restriction on us licensing pretty much.
Yeah.
So that's a very complete, and that product is doing well. It's mm-hmm. And we're actually very excited. There's been a lot of work on that particular product for the 9.2 release, which will be coming out, I don't know, sometime in the next few months for sure. And that's a very big development that's gone on here for that. But, of course, we also license our format support to
Autodesk.
Would be the big one. MapInfo has had it. That's the longest. We're coming up to the 10th anniversary of MapInfo shipping our stuff. And I think we're going to make a small fuss about that soon. But that's a bit hard to believe that they've been faithfully translating with FME technology for nearly 10 years now.
Yeah, that will be a milestone. But I also understand that you have licensed technology from other companies that you have put into FME.
Oh, yes, going the other way. That's a new thing that's just started to happen, and there's a few of them there's some we can talk about and some maybe we can't just yet, but the ones that come to mind are the CurveFit from Tom Inlow's TCI Corporation. The joke that I have there is we're going to put the ARC into ARC Info. What that CurveFit is about is it comes out of the AutoCAD world from years ago. I think Tom's had this around for about 15 years, where you could greatly reduce the size of your files and improve your performance in general, as well as arguably the accuracy of your data. Because his story is that if I've digitized around a cul-de-sac with a bunch of points and I've turned that into a polyline, well, I've got a bunch of points there. That's a lot of data, but I've also got jaggy edges if I zoom in. In reality, that thing is really a circle or a part of a circle. And so he's got this thing that takes lines and analyzes them for portions that seem to be circular and replaces those portions with indeed arcs. And for a long time within our product, as well as many GISs, you had no ability to have an arc in the middle of a line. So it really, this technology wouldn't be of interest. And in fact, if you're doing CAD to GIS translation, you'd typically have stroked them out. Mm-hmm. You'd have turned them into points. But now with ArcGIS and GeoMedia and those kinds of products, being able to support arcs in the middle of paths, FME has been upgraded to do the same thing. And Tom's product is an example of one where we think people may want to apply this. Don has characterized it really as a different form of generalization, really, but a kind of generalization that arguably improves things rather than throws the stuff out. So anyway, they can take a shapefile that's got thousands and thousands of vertices and turn it into something that has maybe 30% fewer vertices involving arcs. Like contour lines, we did a test here. I think we removed about 30% of the vertices by turning these contours into paths that had lines and arcs mixed in. And the result is visually very appealing as well as performant as well.
Right,
and we also have another one as well, which is cleaning. FME doesn't have full-blown cleaning. We have some snapping technology, but a third-party company, MRF Systems.
Geosystems.
Calgary. Out of Calgary, they've had a cleaning technology around for many years now.
It used to be, I think, part of MGE, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And so what they've done is they've added a transformation module to FME, which now with that enables the FME to do full 2D cleaning, and shortly they're going to add full 3D cleaning to the FME. And again, this was an extra cost add-on to FME that's available from us or through them. But they basically looked at our API, looked at the number of users who use FME, and also the formats. Now their thing, again, was a CAD-based solution. Now with the FME, of course, with the 170 formats, they can have a much wider target audience. So,
And the other thing that kind of has come together for us is that thing as well can handle arcs and the middle of lines and preserve arcs and all that sort of stuff. So it's been a big effort for us over the last probably 2.5 years to upgrade our core into a much more modern geometry model, and now we're having these third parties able to take advantage of it. There's a couple more that are brewing, which I don't think we can talk about today, but anyway, this idea of third parties adding some interesting plugins is certainly exciting to us.
Now, you know, the market's getting big enough, you see these parties who are adding it. In many cases, they're being asked by their users. In one of these vendors that basically they had users who were using FME in their thing, and they really pushed these companies to embrace our technology. And then once they look at it, they see, well, it makes total sense. Rather than come to Safe and license, you know, two new formats, they just decided to add their thing to our core, and then they can directly work with 170 formats.
Right, and both of those examples that you gave are really strong examples about this transformation part of
the
scale. Yes, exactly. And it's taken a while for the market to really understand, because still when people think of FME, they think of us in terms of how many formats. But at the end of the day, anybody, Dale often says this, any one person just cares really about three formats, and as long as we have their three formats. But
the problem is that their three formats aren't the same as their friends.
Yeah, everybody has three different formats,
That makes good sense. Okay, so to wrap up, I'd like to have each of you answer this important question. You guys are pretty much the only company that I know of that exclusively does spatial ETL.
Yeah.
And the question is, why do you think your company has been so successful over the past 13 years?
I'll start. So Dale, this is Dale speaking. I think that we won't fool ourselves into thinking that we were particularly brilliant or insightful, but we were fortunate enough to stumble into a niche which was grossly underserved by the other options that are out there and grossly considered to be uninteresting by lots of companies. I remember well, maybe 4 or 5 years into SAFE, going and talking at some conference, and some senior executive from a JS company that doesn't exist anymore, oddly enough, anyway, came over to me, and he smiled and congratulated me for providing this service and sort of shaking his head that he didn't believe anybody would actually want to do what we're doing. And a little bit, I think, that was the attitude out there to some extent, because of course, the vendors that are in the GIS game are in it because they have a tool that makes maps and edits and so on. They're not really in it to try to make it easy to move data between various things. At least traditionally, years ago, they weren't. And so we were able to fill that void. And then the second thing was we were fortunate enough that the original architecture that Don and I came up with in really 94, 95, we were just looking at code this morning from 95, actually, was flexible enough and powerful enough that it could accommodate all these various plugins. And I often like to tell my old story. When I was a young lad, one of the first games I wrote on an Atari computer was a lunar lander. So you had this little ship coming in, you could push some buttons and a thruster would fire. And there was factors in the code about the gravity and the thrust and the resistance and all these things and what they would do to things. And I would set these parameters, and then I would play the game in the universe I just created. And some universes were not healthy, and others were, but you didn't really know what was going to happen. And I like to say that the same thing has happened with FME. We provided this framework, these tools, and we really didn't know what people were going to do with them. And the people out there are early adopters, and then as it became more mainstream, have managed to use the tool in ways that we never would have dreamt. And I think that it's really the flexibility that's in the tool and then the genius of the people that have applied that has combined to make it the success that it's been.
Okay, I'll add a little bit. I think, as Dale said, we were extremely lucky. I think we were lucky in another way as well, in that in the earliest days, the first format we had to support was basically a precursor to the current GML, was the Spatial Archive and Interchange format.
Safe.
And one, it's pronounced SAFE, and that's where we got our name. We sort of played on that. During a conference, we had a history. We had the keynote speaker that actually laid out how the SAIF format eventually has been morphed into the GML format. The point I'm trying to make is that in the earliest days, our core had to support that. And so because our core had to support that, our core wasn't the lowest common denominator. I think other people have tried it, but they tried to basically lower things down to the lowest common denominator, but then you couldn't very well serve any one format in particular. So because of that, you know, we've been very lucky in being able to support these other formats. Also, I think we timed the market well, and again, purely luck. We came out at the time that 32-bit computers were coming out, and that was really critical. Before then, computers weren't really fast enough. Also, we came out about the same time as data was starting to be moved into spatial databases. We had ArcSDE, now we have Oracle Spatial. And just as in the non-spatial world, ETL really required data to get into databases before it could really take off. And so we're pretty excited because now what's happening with organizations is they're starting to put their spatial data into their corporate databases. And once that happens, then these corporate executives are starting to see spatial data, you know, with Google, you know, with Google Earth and with these other things, and they're starting to think, well, geez, I have all this spatial data in my database. How can I use that? And of course, one of the key aspects is being able to get at that data and move it to the applications that can actually use it. So, you know, many people are using our stuff just to dump it in KML and look at it in Google Earth, or now we're seeing they have these big spatial, they have these non-spatial ETL systems that work with all their data on a nightly basis, producing, helping them with fuel their decision support. And so now we're seeing great interest there. So, you know, by and large, I think it comes down to we were extremely lucky. Of course, we work hard, but a lot of people work hard. And also we have a great team. The team of people we have working with us is fantastic. And I think Dale and I were talking the other day, and we said the one thing that I think we've been the most fortunate with, and this is not just our employees but our customers in the industry, is we have just a great industry with great people who are fun to work with. And you know, it's such a great bunch of people in the industry that when we bump into somebody in the sort of the spatial industry who's not friendly and easy to talk to, whether they view us favorably or not, it's actually shocking. So I guess that's...
I mean, really, you know, this user conference at a personal level was also a chance to kind of meet new friends and old friends. I mean, as Don says, the industry is filled with people that, honestly, I'm pleased to say that I'm an acquaintance and a friend of, and that has been a pleasure. I thought of one other thing that we did that I think fed our success, and I like to joke that we were doing this before open source guys made it cool, but that was the idea of really a continuous beta that's online. You know, an argument that's often cited about the open source world is that, hey, if you need a fix, you can get it done, or somebody will do it, or you can build it, and you can get going the next day. Well, we've always had the policy of making our development in-house FMEs available for people that feel like living on the edge. And there's some FME groupies out there that I think check our website every day to see if there's a new one, whether they need it or not. But nonetheless, that process of continuous feedback, getting us something up there, and the people trying it out and giving us feedback has resulted in a massively better product than if we would have only put one up every 6 months, because we've been able to make so many continuous refinements that that over the years it's really, really had a large impact.
Oh, great. And I'm sure there'll be many more releases to come and announcements in the coming years. And, well, thank you so much for your time.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm Adina Schutzberg. Thank you for joining us for this Directions Media podcast. Our music today is from Owen Byrne. You can reach him at byrneworks.com. That's BAERNworks.com. You can reach us at directionsmag.com. Thank you for joining us for the podcast, and be sure to tell a friend.